Hey, listeners, welcome to Music and Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, historian by day, music lover by night. This is a show in which I put music in its historical context. I've got a very special show for you today. Audrey Golden is a music journalist and author who lives here in Catskill, New York. She recently published a book on the history of Factory Records, famous label out of Manchester in the United Kingdom, that tells the story of Factory from the perspectives of the many women who were involved in the label and whose stories have often been left out of the mythologized tale of Factory Records and the Hacienda and so forth. Earlier this month, Audrey went on a book tour throughout the United Kingdom. She's now back. I was lucky enough to tag along on that book tour, and I thought it would be a cool idea to put together a little audio collage from the tour. So that's what I've got for you on today's episode of Music and Time, some clips from her presentation, some music that she talks about from Factory Records in the book, and a little bit of ambiance that I was picking up along the way. It's a bit experimental, but I think it's fun. I've also got Audrey here in studio for some short interview clips to talk about the book and set the scene for some of the stops along the tour. All right, I hope you dig this episode. Without any further ado, here is my experimental audio collage on Audrey Golden's book, I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records. I'm your host, Evan McCormick, on Music and Time in WGXC, and I'm pleased to welcome our special guest today, Dr. Audrey Golden, author of I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
You can hear our cat in the background. I want to start by asking, for the uninitiated, what is Factory Records?
Well, Factory Records is a label that set out to become a cultural phenomenon. It formed in Manchester in the UK, officially in 1978. It started with what they called Factory Nights at the Russell Club, a club in Manchester, and hosted bands like Joy Division, most notably at the start. It became the label of Joy Division, the label of New Order, label of the Happy Mondays. And not only was it creating records and making records in the UK, the US, and elsewhere, but it also got its hands into a lot of different aspects of culture. So Factory Records built the Hacienda, the famous or infamous, however you want to think of it, nightclub in Manchester that existed from 1982 to 1997. It created Dry Bar or Dry 201, a bar that was part of the kind of Factory universe, and hired chefs to create new menus for Dry. It had a Factory New York office that handled a lot of music videos and basically worked with a lot of New York filmmakers, including a lot of women, to craft music videos for its bands. Yeah.
And Factory Records went on to become something of a legendary story beyond the label itself. What is the traditional myth of Factory, the story of Factory that's been so captivating to audiences?
I think what Factory has become for a lot of people is a legendary story, like you said, that is one of an indie record label just full of madness and just crazy antics, and spending far more money than they had on, you know, anything. And it was also kind of crafted by some of its founders and based in different kind of theoretical ideas, especially situationism. And so the legend really is that Factory Records, though, ultimately spent way more money than it had and essentially went bankrupt.
There's a feline story as well that needs to be told here.
There actually was a Factory cat, FAC 191. There was a cat that allegedly hung around the Hacienda. This is a true story. And Factory had this kind of famous or infamous, also, however you want to think of it, a numbering system, and everything got a FAC number. So I'm saying FAC, F-A-C, FAC number. And there was this cat that hung around the hacienda, and it got FAC 191. Nobody knows what happened to the, you know, to FAC 191, and unfortunately no one ever got around to interviewing the cat. So.
And the cat who's participating in this interview here is not numbered. Is
not an unnumbered cat. Yeah. But anyway, so the way that story has often been told is kind of from the perspective of the men who had the idea to found the label and who were kind of the figureheads of the label. And they've really been the central characters. I think that idea of them as the central characters was really perpetuated in the film, although it's a film I love, 24 Hour Party People, that Michael Winterbottom directed, that came out in 2002. Starring Steve Coogan as Tony Wilson. In fact, it turns out that story was pretty incomplete.
And that's where you and this book come in. Can you tell our listeners what you set out to do with this book and where the idea came from?
Yeah, so my book tells a new history of Factory Records from the voices of the women who were really central and really integral to the running of Factory Records in all different kinds of capacities. So while you had these men, as you know, some of the women told me, swanning around, you had women in the offices really running things, handling financial aspects of the label, handling overseas licensing, handling record pressings, handling PR and promotion. You had women running the hacienda. The hacienda actually had the first female manager and licensee in the UK, Ange Matthews. It had the first female doorman, I put the man in scare quotes, Yasmine Lakhani. And then you had women working, doing design work. So for Peter Saville Associates, you had women making music videos. There were a number of actually New York-based women who worked on music videos, like I was saying, and who directed some of, I think, the best-loved Factory music videos. Female chefs working at Dried, creating the menu. There was also an amazing female chef, Suzanne Robinson, at the Hacienda, running the Hacienda canteen. So women really behind the scenes, and sometimes front and center in the bands as well, and just all kinds of capacities, but their stories have never really been told. And so this book is told entirely from their voices as an oral history.
Yeah, it's that's something I wanted to bring out. There's a little bit of narrative in it, but primarily this is a story in which those women's voices are foregrounded. Can you talk a little bit about how many people you tracked down and what it was like to put together an oral history like this?
Yeah, there are, I think, 80 women's voices included in the book in total. I tried to track down even more women than that, but it turns out it's really hard to track people down when they're not, you know, made part of really important histories that they should have been part of. So it was a lot like detective work in some ways. I became sort of like a private investigator trying to find contact information for some of these women. In many cases, it really worked out, and I was able to get contact information, call, email, etc., and was able to speak with a lot of these women. And then in some cases, of course, I wasn't able to. So I think in total, I had a list by the end of the book of 128 women who had done work for and around Factory, and 80 of them I was able to speak with, but I tried to reach out to every single one of them. And I'm sure there are names I missed. I've already had women get in touch who said, oh, I worked at the Hacienda. I didn't know you were working on this book. And, you know, I said, oh, I'd love to hear your story. And so I think that will continue to happen too, and I'd love to be able to involve them in some kind of just future work around the book.
Well, these stories make for incredible reading. In your book, I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records, which is now out on White Rabbit Books in the UK. And our listeners here on WGXC Today are going to be treated to a front row seat on your book tour, which took place earlier in June. You're going to be hearing some clips of your events, my travels, tagging along with the tour, as long as some of the bands that are actually featured in the book. We're going to start things off with a song by one of those bands, Stockholm Monsters, their song Terror. Do you want to say a little bit about who you interviewed from Stockholm Monsters.
Yeah, sure. I interviewed both Lita Hira and Lindsay Anderson, who were part of Stockholm Monsters. Lita Hira was a keyboardist who was actually a classically trained pianist, which is really cool, and played a grand piano on the stage at the Hacienda and allegedly got booed off. You can read more about that in the book. And Lindsay Anderson, who played trumpet in the band and does really amazing work with women in music in the present.
Great. This is Terror, and on the other side of this, we'll pick up the tour where it begins in London. So before the book tour kicked off, our first stop was in London, England, where we arrived maybe just a bit jet-lagged after a midnight stopover in Reykjavik, Iceland. Luckily, you and we had a few days to see friends, rest and restore and celebrate. Is that right?
Maybe a couple days. But yeah, the night we arrived, we had a celebratory dinner with friends at probably one of the great restaurants in the world, Dinner by Heston Blumenthal.
Where somehow they knew that you were celebrating your book release, and we actually still don't know how. But after that extravagant dinner, we immediately went to see Hard Rock Gods, the Melvins, perform one of their 40th anniversary shows at Electric Ballroom in Camden Market. How would you describe that?
I mean, it was a great show. I thought after the fact, this is great. What a way to celebrate the opening of this book tour in London. Melvins and, 15th century meat fruit, which we had at Dinner by Heston. So two things seem disparate, but, actually make for a great celebration material. But the Melvins really rocked Electric Ballroom. I had interviewed Dale Kroeber, a short while before, and was talking to him about this tour in particular, and his drumming was just killer.
I couldn't agree more. So in this segment, you'll hear some of the Factory band Swamp Children, featured Anne Quigley, another of the women that Audrey interviewed for her book, whose stories are truly amazing. You'll hear the Melvins. You'll hear some audio from my walks around London, Liverpool Street Station, Camden Market, really all over, before things really kicked off in Liverpool.
Tuesday, June 6th. It's noon. We've been traveling for 15 hours. The Audrey Golden UK book tour begins.
How does it feel?
I'm tired. I'm tired, and I'm wondering how I might get in touch with Steve Coogan. Scheming.
The hearse rolling alongside us is really putting things kind of a gothic tone to the start.
Yeah, it looks like it was very anachronistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. The people in it also looked like characters in something. It didn't seem real.
They looked like London gangsters to me.
Yeah, I thought so too. Yeah.
Multitudes. These are the sounds of London Liverpool Street Station, June 7th, 2023.
June 7th, we boarded the train for Liverpool in the North, as the Brits call it, for Audrey's first book event, which was a bit of a warm-up for the other stops on tour. Tell us about the Liverpool event.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. So it was the first event, and Sally Williams was interviewing me and doing a kind of Q&A and was awesome. She asked really thoughtful and insightful questions about the book, and really set up the tour amazingly, I thought, with the way she, you know, framed the discussion. And there were some great questions from the audience, so it was exciting to be there.
And the following morning, June 8th, Audrey took off for Manchester to go sign some books. So I stuck around in Liverpool to do a little Beatles tourism. Well worth it. In this segment, you'll hear a clip from Audrey where she talks about how the stories of the women from Factory Records enlivens the myth. Something that came up at a number of the events, and I just couldn't resist playing a bit of a song by some other Liverpudlians not on Factory Records, Echo and the Bunnymen. Then you'll hear my travels down by the Liverpool waterfront, maybe a Beatles tune or two, and we'll catch back up with Audrey in Manchester, where things really got going.
What voices have been marginalized and how can I center those and tell a kind of new enlivening myth of Factory Records? And I think that's what so many of these women do, because I mean, exactly like you said, I mean, they saw Factory as something to aspire to. They saw it as a kind of not just music label, but a kind of cultural force that showed them that they could engage in various creative pursuits, could become fashion designers, could become musicians, could become chefs, could work in all kinds of different ways, and could contribute to this kind of amazing culture around Manchester that Factory created. So I think the book is really celebratory and celebratory of these women's stories.
Thursday, June 8th, Liverpool, North England. We are at the Premier Inn, literally the Premier Inn in Liverpool. I believe the Beatles stayed here in 1964 as they were preparing to release, I don't know. Audrey's just completed her first book event on the tour. What are your thoughts and reflections?
There weren't very many people there.
That's not true.
It is true.
How many were there?
10?
Oh, get out of here. There were like 20 to 25.
No, there weren't.
There definitely were. Friday, June 9th, I'm walking the streets of Liverpool, seeing some of the Beatles sites. I was just in the Cavern Club, which is, of course, not the original Cavern Club, because that was knocked down. It's been restored to its original site, now a shrine to music in general. While walking to the Beatles story, taking in the sounds of the city. It's remarkable. Everything here is, in some way, Beatles-oriented. It's Beatles News, Rubber Soul Pub, Cavern Pub, Revolver Jewelry Store, Beatles News. It's amazing to think you could live in just a musical museum like this.
You'll never know how much I really love you. You'll never know how much I really care. Listen, do you want to know a secret?
Welcome back to Music and Time on WGXC. This is your host, Evan McCormick. We're doing a really cool episode this week documenting Catskill-based music journalist Audrey Golden on her book tour through England last month for her book, I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records, an oral history book. And we're about to pick up with your stop in Manchester, which is, let's say, where most of the book actually took place. Is that right?
Yeah, Factory Records was centered in Manchester. It was actually had its headquarters on Palatine Road in a flat that owned or rented at that time by Alan Erasmus, one of the directors of Factory. So Factory Records actually was run out of like a living room, some bedrooms, and some other rooms in a flat in Manchester. The Hacienda Drive Chorus are in Manchester, and a lot of the women I interviewed for the book still live in and around Manchester.
And a number of them were at the event, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, a number of the women came to the event, and I thought that was just incredibly exciting and really cool to finally get to meet a lot of them in person, since I had done a lot of the interviews over Zoom or over phone. And it was just also really exciting to see them together, a really kind of powerful collective in the audience.
And the event was at the Waterstones in Manchester. Can you tell us a little bit about how the event went?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was great. John Robb did the Q&A with me, the conversation for the book. And I've known him for a while now, since I've been writing for Louder Than War, which he founded and is, I guess, the boss of. So it was great to speak with him and to be able to think through some of the stories in the book and some of the frameworks within the book, with John, you know, asking me about them. And it was really amazing to just get to meet so many of these women. And I'll just say first, you know, this was the first time I'd actually met in person Tracy Donnelly, who the book's dedicated to and who played such a central role at Factory, but also played such a key role in helping me get in touch with a lot of the women I interviewed for the book. So the moment I saw Tracy, it was like, you know, as if I'd already met her and known her for many, many years. So it was really just exciting and awesome to get to finally have that happen.
And listeners will hear a bunch of that event, which I recorded, where you talk about, among other things, the role of women at Factory as an important example of women's work in music, and telling some killer stories as well. And after that, it'll be on top.
Right after my undergraduate degree, I worked near the Of New York, the Factory Of New York building on Spring Street in New York City. And so I kind of walked by, and it was empty at that point, and kind of peer in the windows. I'm like, can I get in there? Are there any badges left on the floor? And still never been inside. But then got to know Tracy Donnelly. Oh, you're way back there now.
Is everybody in the book here tonight?
I received a message in for a few days ago.
Hi, so what was your take on it as you were going and writing and doing your academic work?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan of Joy Division and New Order, I mean, since I was really young. And in the early 90s, I was listening to a lot of kind of the Seattle sound music, and listening to, yeah, a lot of that music, but also listening to a lot of music that came out on soundtracks, because we didn't really have any good radio stations. And so a lot of the stuff I found came through soundtracks. And so when I saw The Crow and heard The Crow soundtrack and heard that Nine Inch Nails cover of Dead Souls, I was like, what is this? This is amazing. And then looked up the original and I thought, oh my God, this is really amazing. This is really amazing. And it just took off from there. You know, kinds of internet research that I was never good at before, such as searching British property records to find people's, you know, addresses and to connect their address. So there's that. But then, God, yeah, I hope young people pick up this book and think, wow, I must have read so many things, or I'm going to encounter so many stories in my life where there are things that are missing. There are voices that have been excluded. There are voices that have been marginalized. And I hope it inspires people, you know, who are interested in music and those stories in the music world, but those stories in kind of any area, to think, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find those stories and I'm going to document them in some regard, because these are stories that should be told.
I think the fact that you could do such a detailed, fantastic book full of so many different people, so many different stories, actually says a lot about Factory. Because I was just thinking then, yeah, if you kind of did this book about a lot of other record labels, I think you wouldn't get 20 pages of the women's stories, would you? You know, it's a lot of kind of famous indie labels. Yeah. The fact that we can get that much, we can get that much out of it.
Yeah.
It's, in a way, it's a celebration of Factory, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely a celebration. Yeah. Been going on at the label, but you don't have everybody, you know, doing all this work and really putting in just a tremendous effort in just so many different areas, then you're not going to have the thing, right? You're not going to have the myth of the thing now. You're not going to have the thing for as long as you had it. I mean, one of the stories for me that was just so kind of critical to tell in terms of work was Penny Henry's work at the Hacienda, in the early years of the Hacienda, and just how much she put into that space and how much of herself she gave to it. I mean, she talks about crawling on the roof to fix a roof slat to prevent leaks from coming in. I mean, Penny Henry climbed onto the roof of the Hacienda to prevent it from flooding, essentially. How amazing.
I read that and I couldn't work out how she would even get on the roof.
For me, an oral history is such an important and kind of democratic way
of telling stories of experiential knowledge. And so that's really what this, you know, I think is. And it's a form that doesn't subordinate certain voices to others. It makes clear, like, this is an egalitarian form in which all of the voices come together and tell a story collectively. And you can't do that if the author is constantly, you know, coming in with, well, let me set the scene for you, right? I tried to give a little bit of just kind of thematic context at the beginning of each chapter. But yeah, I really wanted the voices of everyone I spoke with to be the ones who came together to tell the story.
We're back on WGXE with Music and Time. This is Evan McCormick with Dr. Audrey Golden, music journalist and author of I Thought I Heard You Speak, an oral history of women at Factory Records. We're tracking your book tour through the UK, which was a smash success earlier this month. And we're about to pick up on the next stop, which was Oxfordshire, where you were on the billing for Kite Festival. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what Kite Festival is?
Yeah, it's a really cool music and combined literary festival in Oxfordshire, obviously, with a lot of work from Jeff Barrett, who founded Heavenly Records. So I was in the Heavenly Records tent doing a book talk, which went just amazingly and was really exciting. And during this event, not sure if Evan's gonna have any clippings of this, but as I was speaking, could hear the Pretenders doing a sound check for their show. And so thought, wow, this is the only point in my life where I'm gonna get kind of cut off by Chrissy Hynde, but what a moment.
in my mind, this was one of the standout events on the tour. Who did you speak to on stage?
Yeah, I loved this event. I think this was my favorite event of the trip over, although don't tell anybody in the other cities, you know, because those were fabulous too. But the amazing Emma Warren, a great writer who has a new book out as well, did the interviewing of me and Jane Houghton, who did PR for Happy Mondays, New Order, and a lot of other factory bands. So yeah, it was Jane and me up on stage with Emma.
And in this segment, listeners, you're going to hear a bit from Kite Festival, including some of the incredible stories from Jane Houghton. And there's one in particular regarding managing, doing PR for the Happy Mondays while they were in New York City. There was an absolute riot. It came up at almost every event. It's a killer story. It'll probably play some Mondays as well. You'll hear some sounds from Kite Festival, including the Pretenders, as mentioned. And there was also this incredible serendipitous moment where I happened to wander over to a tent with my tape recorder out and just happened to catch Susanna Hoffs of the Bangles singing a bit of a cappella.
Yeah, Eternal Flame, I think.
That tells the story of Factory Records in an entirely new light from the perspectives of dozens and dozens of women like Jane and many other amazing women who did work for and around Factory Records, but whose stories by and large have been entirely excluded from Factory narratives to date. So obviously Factory Records has been kind of entrenched in, you know, music, myth, legend, cultural myth, legend. But so many of those stories really center around the men who form the label and, you know, are often portrayed as, you know, being wild and crazy, gallivanting around, swanning about, not caring about finances. And, well, how do you keep a record label running? How do you promote the artists? How do you get sleeves designed for records? How do you get music videos made? As it turns out, you hire a lot of women to work behind the scenes. And this book is about really telling their stories from their perspectives. So people have asked, is this a takedown of Factory Records? No, absolutely not. Were there experiences of sexism that these women, you know, experienced? Yes, absolutely. But this is really about getting their stories and including those experiences of misogyny and, you know, working in a really patriarchal culture, but also having a lot of fun while doing it, doing amazing work and being part of this Manchester scene that ultimately spread, you know, to the South, spread across to New York. and just became a massive cultural influence. So that's what the book's about.
I don't even know what the Mundys were doing in New York. But we went to New York. We were stuck in the Paramount Hotel for 3 days before I'd even seen anybody. You know, I just actually wanted to come back. I wasn't doing my job because I hadn't found any band members for her to interview or the photographer to take pictures of. I herded, again, like feral sheep. I managed to herd everyone up. Apart from Sean, who was still missing. Nobody knew where Sean was. And I was just over it by then. I was losing my mind. You know, we just needed to do the job and get home. And so one of the band said, oh, you'll have to do some new pictures because Sean shaved his head. Sean shaved his head yesterday on a night out. Well, fucking course he did. Of course he shaved his head. So we'll do the photos again with his new shaved head. So I stood outside, and then this really proper flashy car pulled up with its sort of window half down, and I saw this stubbly head. I was like, oh, thank God. So I went bombing out and shouted, where the fuck have you been? Window went right down, and it's Sinead O'Connor. And she's like, what? And I just, how do you get out of that? You can't say, sorry, love, I thought you were Sean Ryder.
Stop of the tour brought you back to London for a magical night at Walthamstow Trades Hall. This was like a massive event. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the panel?
Yeah, so this was the biggest panel of any of the events and also the biggest crowd, I think, so that was really exciting. The panel was made up of women who I had interviewed in my book, so it was Bindi Binning, and I'm going to use surnames as they were then and how they're written in the book. So Bindi Binning, who did A&R for Factory 2, she was really one of the only women doing A&R at that time, and so, you know, had a really incredible role and in my mind is a real trailblazer and a really amazing woman. So Bindi Binning. Tina Simmons, who was a factory director, is not often named as a director in existing histories, but was in fact a director and came up with a financial plan to save the label from ruin, but essentially was sacked for that important work. And then we had Gani Rietveld, who was a key member of the band Cuando Quango and also worked for a number of years at the Hacienda, so was really involved in the factory scene in a lot of different ways. And then we had Simone Marie on the panel of Primal Scream, amazing bass player for Primal Scream, and fabulous, fabulous DJ.
And who chaired the panel?
And it was chaired by Stephanie Phillips of the band Big Joni, who I admire just intensely and am really quite a fangirl of. So it was really, really cool to have Steph chairing the panel.
This was a really cool event series. It's called the Rock and Roll Book Club at Walthamstow Trade Hall in Walthamstow neighborhood of London, put on by a gent named Mark Hart with help from Simon Cardwell. You'll hear an interview clip with them. I got to catch up with them after the event. It also happened to be Mark Hart's birthday, and Simon Cardwell got the crowd to sing happy birthday to him, which ended up being kind of special for Mark Hart. Why was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was a really amazing event, not just because the musicians who were on the stage, including Gani Rietveld and Steph Phillips of Big Joni, were singing happy birthday to him, but also because the members of the Raincoats were in the audience and also singing happy birthday to him. So I'm currently working on a new book project that I'm really excited about, a book on the incredible feminist punk band, the Raincoats, who are just someone everybody should know. So I can hopefully say more about that later in time. But Mark Hart, like any good music listener, of course knows the Raincoats, recognized them immediately that they were there. And when everyone started singing happy birthday, he said, "I can't believe the Raincoats are singing happy birthday to me." So it's also cool for me because I was singing happy birthday to Mark as well, so I also sang with the Raincoats on this the night of this event in London, so there you go.
And hey, I was the guy with the tape recorder, so I am pleased to present to our listeners a bootleg recording of happy birthday, including the Raincoats and Big Joni. You'll hear it next.
I'm going to record. In fact, we're here at Walthamstow Trade Hall on June 12th, the big event for Audrey's book. I'm here with Sarah Witt.
I'm so excited about this. I can't stand it.
How would you describe this venue?
This venue is perfect. It has an appropriate amount of fans for London. It's cool. It's set in an era that everybody's trying to recreate in their own homes, but it's completely authentic.
Yeah, I feel like we've arrived in 1979. Like
I'm
the
ready
height,
to
yeah,
hear.
Yeah, the height of factory rock.
Yeah.
I think
That's
Audrey
exactly.
may be coming out here.
Is this working? Oh, it is. Hi. Thanks so much for coming. There's so many people on such a sunny evening. So my name's Stephanie Phillips. I'm a music journalist and musician. I'll be chairing the panel. This is for I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records, written by Audrey Golden Hit. So we're going to be hosting, yeah, thank you.
We were allowed to be creative, and I mean we, everybody, ladies, lads, boys, girls, all the artists, anyone could come up with ideas. It didn't always get taken up. But then I might find out about it several months later when Tony says, "Oh, I've had a good idea." And it happens to be the one you talked about, you know, 7 months before. But irrespective of that, we worked as a family. We did give lots back to Manchester. We did create things for Manchester. And as I said before, I stayed in Manchester. I didn't come back to London. There's something about it. And I think that legacy is there. It's that understanding that of the people coming together and being creative.
So obviously there's a very much of an economic legacy of factory and Hacienda, because that creativity, although factory and Hacienda didn't make money, but a lot of money was invested into Manchester, a lot of people came into Manchester, and Manchester grew in all aspects. But I think in terms of the music speaks for itself, but I think the ethos of factory, which was very much, as Tina said, creativity, creativity over everything, creativity over business, is what I guess most bands go into music for, which is to make their music, but to make it on their own terms. And they're very much not allowed to do that if they're signed to big labels. Whereas the ethos of factory was very much just do what you want to do. If it sells, hurrah. If it doesn't sell, we're on to the next one. So I think it worked out for some of the bands. For some of the bands, it just didn't work out. Would they have benefited from a bit more nurturing and a bit more interference? Probably in terms of their career success. But bands being bands want to do things their own way anyway. So I think part of the legacy is just this being able to be creative on your own terms, especially now when so many musicians can distribute their own music without having to go through a big corporate machine.
It's kind of odd because it kind of seems like we're all talking with each other, and like Ruth Polske booked a lot of the factory bands for the United States, particularly for New York, Washington, Philadelphia. I mean, she had a strange accident, a freak accident a long time ago, so she's dead. But it kind of feels like she's part of that conversation because of the way that it's been edited. Yeah.
And I'm just a reader of narrative oral histories, and I'm sure you all have come across this. And until you write one, you kind of think, it almost seems as if everybody's in a room together speaking. But in fact, one of the, you know, I guess, tricks of the narrative oral history is that the writer of the book isn't really a writer. I mean, I'm a writer, but I think of myself more as somebody, you know, working on a really extraordinary collage, or I've been saying a knitter, a really fantastic knitter, or somebody, you know, working on a loom, really thinking of ways to put together these stories in ways that are really beautiful and fantastic and speak to one another and enliven one another. And so in that process, there was some resurrection of the dead, as Gandhi says, yes. One about the book, and then something that kind of closes the book. I mean, for me, putting together this book and, you know, looking through the final product, which I hope you're all enjoying doing, I really, you know, came to understand, and I hope this is something that everyone will get from the book, that this legacy of Factory Records as this enormous cultural, just glorious behemoth in a lot of ways that has arms, you know, far outside Manchester, that reaches to New York, that reaches down into the South, that reaches into London, that reaches into mainland Europe, that reaches into Australia, that sort of has an impact globally, but also across time. That legacy, it really just becomes that once you understand all of the amazing and incredible hard work that all of these women put in to make the label what it was. So Factory started out, and the original directors wanted to have this cultural behemoth. And I think this book, you know, with all of these incredible voices, really enlivens that myth, enlivens that legend, and shows the ways that Factory has staying power, not just in music, but in film, in art, in design, in culinary arts, food, in electronic music, in business, in all of these different facets. And for me, I think that's a real lasting legacy of Factory Records. And then I thought I'd just come around and end with something that another amazing woman I spoke with for the book said. And I'll tell you, when I was speaking with her and she said this, I knew it was going to be the end of the book. I didn't speak to her nearly toward the end of the interview process, but she said this, and I thought, that's the end of the book. I knew it was going to be the last thing I put in the book. It was Teresa Allen. She worked at the Hacienda for a decade, an incredible person, a really hard worker. And she told me, you know, I was a little nervous to speak for the book, and she was thinking about it, and her son was friends with people, you know, who know the Hacienda, know it well. And one of her son's friends said, if your mom worked at the Hacienda, why can't I find her on Google? And she said, it's because her name hasn't been written down anywhere. And the existing histories
I won't name any names, but Teresa's name got spelled wrong. Teresa's job got mentioned wrong when it got mentioned at all. And so she said it was really important to get this story down for history, to get this down for the history books. And then she kind of paused and she said, but do you know what? We put in all this hard work, day in and day out, and we did it because, God damn, it was fun.
So I've been hanging around on Mark's coattails for quite some time. He's probably going to absolutely hate me for this, but it's his birthday tomorrow. So I wondered if everybody could sing happy birthday to Mark. Come on, people.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Mark. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you, Mark. After this, I think that was the last question, actually. Where do you go from that? We do have copies of Audrey's absolutely essential book at the back. Audrey will sign those books that people have already bought, and we've got some we'd love you to purchase. It is utterly indispensable. As we've heard tonight, what Audrey has done is utterly remarkable. For 40 years, someone said there's 35 books about Factory, Joy Division, New Order, Happy Mondays in the canon, and nobody in that time thought of what Audrey did. So, it's remarkable. A massive round of applause for Audrey. Huge round of applause. Superlative hosting.
I'm the organiser of the Walthamstow Rock and Roll Book Club.
My name's Simon. I help Mark run these events here in Walthamstow.
Help is a moot. It's a debatable word.
And how long has this Rock and Roll Book Club been running?
I think it's about 6 years. Of course, the pandemic has kind of thrown things out of kilter, so it may have been longer. I don't know.
So it was January 2016. Mark did his first event here. There was 20 people here. His third event, there was 6 people here. He has now grown it to the point where it regularly sells out this room, draws more people every week than the equivalent other book events around him, easily. So that's all down to Mark.
Mark, what's the secret to this success?
Me, primarily. No, we live in very interesting times. One of the things we'll be looking at in the next few weeks is the rise and fall of the weekly music press. That, there's a demand for that. There's an interest in these stories. And the music press is no longer there to satisfy that in the way that it used to. And you know I'm talking about the Enemy and the and Sounds and the Melody Maker and all of that, which used to sell hundreds of thousands. What we have instead are publishers bringing to us some really great music books. And I've always enjoyed reading music books. I set this up because I was reading music books and little else, and I had no one to talk to about these things. So I sought companionship.
Simon, what can you say about tonight other than the fact that it's stifling?
It is hot. We don't. We're not used to it being this hot in England, you see. We're used to it being cold and miserable. But yeah, it's been a great night. It's always a great night. But you have to have the books, have to have the content to be able to do these sort of talks.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Music and Time on WGXC. I'm your host, Evan McCormick. And I want to thank Audrey Golden for coming on the show and talking about her book and her book tour. For I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women in Factory Records, out now on White Rabbit Books in the UK, and next year out in the United States as well. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep, out January 2024 on Hachette, so you'll be able to buy it at all good bookshops in the US. But in the meantime, keep your eyes peeled because there may be some events, in fact, very soon, in the Hudson Valley for you to attend and potentially pick up an import copy, so...
And I'll be back next month with another episode of Music in Time. Look forward to listening with you then.